Morning.
How are you, Roger?
Mustn't grumble, as we say, where I come.
Well, it's 12 p.m. in your place.
And it's 12 noon. Well, it's 12.02 p.m., yeah.
12.02 p.m., well, it's 6 in the afternoon in the Netherlands. So, all right, let's get started.
So, why don't we get started?
This podcast is called EduKitchen, and yeah. I like to interview critical thinkers like Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, Glenn Greenwald, Roger Waters, people who dare to think beyond the common narrative we are taught in schools. So that's the reason why I invited you to my podcast, EduKitchen. So before we start, Roger, do you have any questions?
No, I don't. But I have a comment, and my comment is this. I was just talking to a young woman in London called Fiona Lully, who stood in the general election for Stratford and Bow.
Yeah.
And she's not a member of parliament, but she's still thinking. And I haven't spoken to her since July 5th or 6th, just after the election. And she called me today and left a message. So I called her back, which is why I'm a bit late coming on to this Zoom meeting with you. But it was fascinating because she said two or three things that sucked me into a conversation. She said, books, not bombs. And I thought, well, that's a perfectly decent slogan. Okay. Yeah. And I said, this sounds like the beginning of a pamphlet. So I said to Fiona, it is possible that you may become the l'ami du peuple, you know, I don't know if that was one of the Corday's or whoever it was, but back in 1789 in France, the friend of the people. Because she had said before, you know, she told me about books, not bombs, that we had agreed rather than sit around worrying about why Kamala Harris is playing the race card and all of that nonsense about the American election, we have to look at the roots of what is going on. And Fiona mentioned almost immediately education, 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 education. And of course, she's absolutely right, which is why it is correct that she is now thinking about writing revolutionary pamphlets like L'Ami du Peuple. And I hope my conversations with her will continue into the future because she's a very bright, young woman.
She is. I saw your conversation on Double Down News.
Oh, okay.
And I wrote you an email. I said, what a bright light she is. What a shining example for the next generation. Because, you know, I watched many of your interviews, and one of the reasons, one of the more recent one is yours with Piers Morgan. And I thought the way he approached the interview was dreadful. You were not given a chance to speak. He was constantly interrupting you. So that was really bothering me. But I think the way you handled it was amazing. I really liked, even more than the topics you discussed, the way you handled Piers Morgan. I think that's quite a challenge.
Well, thank you, because you can't have a conversation with Piers Morgan, because his modus operandi is constant interruption, gainsaying of anything that you might say, and an attempt always to create a fight on TV. Because that's what he sells, you know, that's his clickbait. So, yeah, I was very much in two minds as to whether to speak to Piers Morgan or not, because he'd been trying to get me to speak. And actually, I realised I was just in London for a very few days and the general election was happening. And I realised there was no other alternative to being a presence somewhere on YouTube or on TV or because there's no way that any English TV station is going to give me any airtime at all. And the reason for that is, just to get straight to the point, this was what I said to Fiona this morning as well. I said, Fiona, what I'm doing, and I'm not suggesting that you need to do this necessarily, but it's not a bad yardstick by which to judge things, is I always bring everything back to December the 10th, 1948, Paris, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the fledgling United Nations, because it's taken me a long time to figure this out. I'll be 81 later this week. But it is quite clear that if we all subscribed to that declaration, and if we all abided by those 30 articles that are in it, war would be over forever. There wouldn't be any point in you and I having a conversation like we're having now, because we wouldn't be committing genocide in Palestine. And I wouldn't be having to listen to Mehdi Hassan devoting some of, he's got a new sort of podcasty thing. It's called Zio something. I'm not sure quite what it is called, Zitio or something like that. And I've got nothing really against him. You know, I think his heart's in the right place. But he was having a long discussion with some bloke who purports to represent a resistance to the Taliban in Afghanistan about how somebody might do something about that. And they got onto the fringes of, oh, maybe the United States were wrong to withdraw their troops because look how badly the Taliban treat women, you know. And you go, well, hang on, Mehdi, if you'd done your reading, you'd be saying, hang on, we should start this not at the beginning, back in 1832, when the Brits tried to invade Afghanistan and did for a bit and blah, 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 and all of that history. But we could at least go back to the history where Afghanistan had a functioning socialist government.
Yeah.
And the Russians actually went in to try and support the idea of a democratic socialist state in Afghanistan, where everybody had, oh, guess what? Equal human rights, whatever their sex, as well as their religion or nationality. I will pause for a moment. But yes, isn't this all fascinating?
It is fascinating. And I don't mind if you go into a certain direction, because I believe that the conversation will lead itself. So but the main topic is education. And I remember being in second grade of high school in the Netherlands, where I'm from. And I had to watch Brick in the Wall, and I didn't understand. I liked the song, We Don't Need No Education, but I didn't understand. But now it's become an anthem for me as well, as a teacher. And I think it's one of the biggest challenges for me in education is to raise critical citizens. It's so difficult as a teacher to go beyond the narrative, beyond the textbooks. So I think for many teachers around the globe who are in this factory system, as you presented in the clip, We Don't Need Your Education, the biggest challenge also in American education and British education is to raise critical citizens. And you, Roger, have become a very critical citizen, although you have attended English high school and English primary school. So how come the system didn't get you?
Well, funny you should ask, because one of the jobs that I'm doing at the moment is I'm writing a memoir. And so I have written about my school days, particularly not so much my primary school education, because my mother actually taught at the primary school. She never taught me. It was part of the thing she made quite clear when she took the job. She went, I'm not going to teach either of my sons, who will both be coming, because this is where we live, to this primary school, All in Memorial Primary School. So I never learned from her, but I do know what her teaching methods were, because she'd been educated at a place in London, in Roehampton, called the Froebel Institute, where they taught a very revolutionary, not as revolutionary as A.S. Neil, but a very revolutionary form of teaching, which was this. It was based around something that they called center of interest. And I can remember my mother used to teach center of interest. And what this was, it was about the idea that if you find a subject like Stone Age people and how they live in Great Britain, something like that, you could then construct your lessons around making models, playing the game, making theatre about how these people live, what their life was actually like, and possibly even how they thought or felt, and whether or not they were interested in Stonehenge or whatever, anything. So it's partly historical, but it's also tactile. Let's make fucking models of dinosaurs or what. Let's interest the imagination of our children so that they think, oh my God, that's what Britain was like before history, prehistory. And it doesn't matter which part of history you choose. It's like Mehdi What's-His-Face in his conversation with this clearly right-wing, let's reimpose military rule on Afghanistan so we can steal Afghanistan yet again from the Afghani people. And we do it on the pretense that we're going to make life better for women. So that's our platform, whatever. But if instead of that, they would say, well, hang on, let's have a look at Afghanistan and let's think about the idea of government. So who should get to govern us? Should it be blokes with beards who want to cover women up completely, and which is kind of archaic in the way of thinking of you and me, if you like, what we might call Western civilization. But it's not to them. It's, why is that? Have they been brainwashed to believing some kind of weird connection with God that says women should be covered in sacking from head to foot from the moment they're born? And I don't know, but we could at least look at it, couldn't we? And might we not say, well, hang on a minute, maybe they're different than we are, or maybe the fledgling United Nations was right, and that we're actually all brothers and sisters because we have incredibly close DNA. And when we study individually our genomes, we can say where our ancestors are from, almost down to 30 or 40 square miles.
It's true. You know, a couple of months ago, I interviewed Jane Elliott. You might know Jane Elliott. She's a regular host at Oprah Winfrey, and she has a slogan, and she always says, there's only one race, the human race, nothing else. It's about what you're saying. When you trace back our DNA, as you said before many times, we're all African. It's hard to believe for some people.
Yeah, but very hard, particularly Italian journalists.
Why?
I say that because I went with Their Mortal Remains, which was the exhibition of old crap from Pink Floyd. My friend Aubrey Powell designed and put on a very good exhibition in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. And I have to say, I take my hat off, it was fine. And the Victoria and Albert did a great job. But then a kind of cheaper version got peddled around the world so that people could make some money out of it. And I, for my sins, went to the opening in Rome. And it was so dull, the whole thing. But there were hundreds. Was Gilmore there? No, he wasn't. But Nick Mason was. And we sat in a press conference in this thing. And when I told this room full of Italians that we're all African, it was so precious. It was a pin drop moment. They went, no, no, we're Italian. We're not African. And it freaked them out completely. Yeah. Could watch them being freaked out at this idea that you can't tell we're different just because we look like a Chinese person or someone from Africa. No, no, we're not. We are all Homo sapiens. And it's such a relief to those of us who believe in love and truth to know that. But it's not a relief to people who believe they're superior in some way, to people who slightly different. It's insane. Anyway.
So your mother worked in a different kind of school, you might say, is some kind of experimental school that was interest based. I should say.
No, it wasn't different. It was standard English primary school.
What?
Maybe it was slightly different because she was teaching there and had learned some new modern techniques from the Froebel Institute, the main technique being we have to interest children and entertain them and amuse them. We can't sit them down and teach them by rote, which is what the whole American system of education is based on, you know, with multiple choice answers to set questions. That is a terrible way of trying to teach people things, partly because it steers you away from truth and love. And it steers you towards cold, hard numbers.
Well, I get truth because they have their own truth. But love, I don't get love. How does it steer you away from love?
Because it doesn't ask you to value your connection with the Chinese and the Africans and to accept the fact that you're all human and that as a human being, you have a responsibility, if you can, to express what I believe is your innate capacity to empathize with others. So rote education, multiple choice answers, blah, 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 and all of that doesn't help you to explore that part of yourself, whereas center of interest does. Let's have a look at China. What if part of our education, or American education, for instance, was to actually look at what actually happens in China, not just now, but the history of China, the immensely, unimaginably long history of the culture, politics, and history of that bit of the world, as compared with the very, very short history, for instance, of the United States of America, assuming it starts in 1776. It doesn't, of course. It starts in the
1400s.
Yeah, 15th century.
Yeah. So what you're saying is Chinese history isn't taught in American high schools.
It wasn't taught in English high schools either. We never learned anything about China. The only reason I know anything about the history of China and why it's in some of my songs, watching TV is a song of mine on Amused to Death. I think it's on Amused to Death. We were watching TV. And then it's the story of a Chinese girl who dies in the protests in Tiananmen Square, whatever year that was. Her father was an engineer. She had this and that and the other and blah, blah, blah. And that's a long song. But in the song, somehow, in 1948, Mao Zedong got quite irate and he kicked that old dictator Chiang out of the state of China.
Okay, check. Yeah.
Chiang Kai-shek went off to Formosa and they formed the island of blah, blah, blah. And they, Kumoi and the fans were flying across the China Sea. It's just completely prophetic of what they're trying to repeat now. Except that now it will end in the Third World War, when then it ended in the separation of Taiwan from mainland China. And all that came after that, that was eventually resolved in 1971, when the rest of the world accepted that it is part of China, that there's a 1% and it's China, and that they will resolve whatever problems there are with Taiwan amongst themselves, and the Chinese people should be left alone. Well, now, particularly the government of America has changed its mind about that, followed obviously by all the poodles in Europe, including the United Kingdom, to its eternal shame. And they say, no, we're not having that. We're gonna have a war with China about it. So, but a lot of this stems from the fact that none of us are taught anything about China. No. We might know that they invented gunpowder, but that's about it.
Except for the fact that the same goes for Russia. We don't know Russian history either. The only thing we know is that communism didn't work. And they always go back to Mao's communism, Stalin's communism, Pol Pot's communism. But that's not the way Engels and what's the other guy's name? Marx invented it. Nobody read Das Kapital. And that's a whole different kind of communism. It's a different concept. The way Stalin used communism is not the way it could have been. So nowadays, you know, and it would be nice if people and children...
Yeah, the basic economic theory is that the workers own the means of production.
That's it.
So it's only in its antithesis to capitalism, which is completely, you know, the whole idea is completely diametrically opposed. Either the people own the means to production or somebody with money does. But that's the only real difference. And yeah, of course, it failed in the form that it was because it became authoritarian and whatever. But it didn't from the outset in 1917. All the history from there until 1989, when it finally went, all right, USSR is crumbling and we're going to pull back and blah, 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 blah. All of the rest of it was not a failure. If you look at Russia today, if one was to visit Russia today, you discover a people who actually have clung to more of their ability to think and their ability to love one another than the West has, because they haven't, well, recently they've been devoted to neoliberal economics, but only quite recently, last 30 years or so. Yeah. Anyway, that's another conversation that we're making.
So let's go back to education. So
yeah.
Those principles your mother had, were you taught those principles in school as well, or did you have a totally different kind of education?
We were, to some extent. Yeah, we were. We were. And I did learn stuff. I even learned stuff in the grammar school. You know, there are different terminologies. In England, a grammar school, when I was growing up and going to school, simply meant the elite one-fifth of the population went to a different school from the other 80%. So 20% went to what were called grammar schools. And that's where you learn to be lawyers and leaders of men and women or whatever. And the other 80% went to what were called secondary modern schools. And that is where the lab assistants and cleaning ladies and bus drivers were educated. And we got rid of it in England, I'm happy to say, but not until the middle of the 60s, when we started to, in England, support something called comprehensive education, which meant that everybody went to a secondary school. But there was streaming, and you could move, depending upon your performance and your intellectual capacity, you could move from one stream into another. So you could arrive anywhere in the 100% of that generation of children. So we got rid of the, you have failed, you have succeeded, you are the elite. So I know that's a side issue in some ways, except it's not, because education in England became more egalitarian. Though we never got rid of what we call public schools, but were actually private schools.
Yeah.
It's just a daft way the English have of using their own language.
Yeah, so anyway. What kind of student were you?
What?
What kind of student were you yourself?
I was the kind of student who famously one year when I was 14 or 15 or something, you get marked on work that you do, right? And you get graded. And you get graded in terms of how you compare with the other 31 children who are in the same class that you are. I was the kind of student who could come 32nd based on my performance in all of my term work, all the work I did during the term, and first in the exams at the end of the thing. So I was not very good at putting my nose to the grindstone, but I was quite bright, if I could put it like that. But I was fighting my whole time at my grammar school was one long act of resistance. And very interestingly, I tried to get in touch with a guy from my grammar school who I hardly knew. His name was John Pocock. If you'd said, who's that, when I was at school, I would have gone, I don't know, he's that little kid, whatever. Apparently, he was 6 months older than me. I only discovered this 2 weeks ago. And the reason I discovered it was because he was very important in a particular episode. This is a complete digression, but it's interesting. We had a combined cadet force at school. So you pretended you were in the army or something. The only good thing about it was you could shoot guns, and you did on a firing range.
Real guns. Wow.
Which, real guns, very sexy. Bang. Old Lee Enfield 303 rifles. Wow. But you could also shoot BSA Martini .22 rifles. And some of us shot in a league. We'd go to a public school where they had a shooting range. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. So there was the army, which everybody had to join. And then a couple of years later, you could decide you wanted to be in the naval section or the RAF section. And you could leave behind the khaki Brillo pads that the, you know. So I joined the naval section. Anyway, I'm going to cut a very long story very, very short. And eventually I was made a leading seaman or something. And it may well have been that I may have been allowed my authority to get carried away. I don't know. But on a weekend, we used to go on weekends, the naval cadets, to, I don't know, a battleship somewhere or a shore station. We went one weekend to a shore station in Rosyth, which is near Edinburgh in Scotland. Okay. And while we were there, and we were in kind of huts living, and I think we were in small rooms that were like two double bunks to each other. Well, I'm in a room with three other blokes, and suddenly in the middle of the night, the doors burst open, and in come a bunch of my comrades, led by some fucking thug. and so they removed my pajama bottoms or whatever I was. Yeah, and I promise you I fought back a bit. I didn't like this at all. And they put black boot polish on my balls.
Okay, no.
As a mark of disrespect. Oh, yeah, you can laugh now. All right. So anyway, I fought like, you know, anyway, you'll have to read the memoir about the number of times that some kind of authority that I considered errant overpowered me in some way. It happened first when I was about 2 years old, some teacher in an ashram. Anyway, this was important. It was an important moment. Very terrible feeling of powerless, fighting back. One lucky punch hit the smallest boy in the gang of invading whatnots and blacked his eye. Well, his name was John Pocock, Johnny Pocock. And I've never forgotten him because the next day he came up to me privately and apologized for having been part of the attack. He said, I've thought about it and I really regret that I joined him with that. It was completely wrong and blah, 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 blah. And I was very moved by that, I remember at the time. And I said, well, Johnny, thank you so much for coming. I feel quite moved now, you know, aged nearly 81. And I said, but I apologize for punching you in the eye. I wasn't aiming at you. I was fighting for my fucking life, you know. I was in flight, fight, or flight, you know, mode. I was pouring adrenaline with every gram I could squeeze out of my adrenal glands. And he said, I know you were. I felt the punch. Anyway, so that's the thing. So I'm writing my memoir and I'm going, I wonder if my misdeeds, my misuse of my authority as a leading seaman in the CCF warranted this attack upon me by this gang of thugs in this small wooden room and whatever. I'd love to know. I'm going to call Johnny Pocock. I've never seen him since that day. Well, I did maybe see him at school in the distance.
So you wanted to know if some higher ranking officer gave the order?
Not an officer, a leading seaman, which is... Yeah. Oh, no, there was no officer involved in the leading of the thugs. That would have just been... I think it was some village idiot who was full of testosterone and bad ill humor. And I met him again later in the street in Cambridge. He came up to me. It may even have been after I started Pink Floyd. I've no idea, but I remember this kid coming and I recognized him immediately. And he came up all jolly and wanting to say hello and, you know, oh, da, 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 da. And I did that thing that people do to people sometimes, where it's just as if the other person doesn't exist. They're not there. I totally blanked him. I may have looked through him or past him or sideways, but it was just as if he didn't exist. That was my response. It was that violent, my response. I didn't raise a finger or a flicker of an eyebrow, or I just ignored him completely and then walked away. Anyway, that's another story. But I wanted to know whether I was the villain or the victim. Am I the perpetrator and I'm punished reasonably by the perp? Or was this something more like it felt to me? Was I the victim? So it's an interesting question. I thought, who should I ask? Johnny Pocock. So I found his number, blah, 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 blah. And I kept, nobody answered. And then I went, are you sure this number's right, to the researchers who I'd got to? And also I discovered a news item about him in the Cambridge Daily News, describing the fact that he had run an estate agency all his life and he was now retired. But in his off time, when he wasn't working, he'd been painting, an amateur painter. And now that he'd retired, he was painting full time. And what was he painting? He was painting landscapes of all the places that I knew as a boy in Cambridge. And they're beautiful paintings. You can look them up. John Pocock, right?
John Pocock.
Anyway, eventually, the word came from my researcher, bad news, he's dead.
Really?
Yeah. And I went, fuck, really wanted to talk to him, you know. And then in the interview he'd done and the newspaper article about him, I saw he was married to a woman called Janet. And he had been in the newspaper article, which was a couple of years ago, for 58 years. And I thought, fuck me, that's she's my generation.
Yeah.
Anyway, I got her on the phone last week. I spoke to her last week. She finally answered the phone. I went, is this Mrs. Pocock? Yes. You know, Janet, yeah, may I call you? Yes. And I told her who I was. And she said, oh, yes, John used to mention you.
Really?
You know? Yeah. And I went, fascinating. Well, I had written her quite a long WhatsApp before starting off. I mean, I could read it to you, but it's sort of, dear Mrs. Pocock, you don't know me and I don't know you. But first of all, as the Irish have it, I'm sorry for your loss. And please, I don't want to step over any emotional boundaries or anything, blah, 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 blah. I knew your father, I knew your husband when we were both younger, and blah, 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 blah. And I never heard back from her until when she did answer the phone. She had never looked at her texts, so she hadn't seen the letter. And I had a really lovely conversation with her. But all I got from, I couldn't ask her that question, because how the fuck would she know? She wouldn't know. I needed him, because he might have had a memory.
He might have told it by chance, maybe.
Yeah, I think it's very unlikely, but he might have done, because in the conversation I had, this is fascinating, Janet Pocock told me how much Johnny had enjoyed his school days and what a really good school the Cambridgeshire High School for Boys was.
Really?
And here I am, just rebelling like beyond anything you could imagine.
The same school,
yeah. So isn't it interesting that two boys who involved in this weird, brutal melee in a hut in Rosyth Dockyard can be at the same school, and one of them leave it going, what a great education that was, and the other one could leave it going, fuck me, I'm glad I'm out of there. Now I can actually get on with some real life.
Really?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? You particularly as an education, you know, as a teacher.
Yeah. So one day you decided to write the song Breaking the Wall, and the famous sentence, we don't need no education. What events did you think of when you were writing these sentences?
I didn't one day decide. In 1977, this is the very short true story. Okay, I'm on stage. We've just put out Animals after Dark Side of the Moon and Wish You Were Here Animals. And so we're now in the middle of the Animals tour. Well, in the Animals tour, we only played Wish You Were Here and Animals. We didn't do any of Dark Side because that was what we decided. We're not going to go back to old glory. We're going to do, and we did that. And it was a miserable tour. We were playing huge stadiums and I hated it. And it was during that tour, I had the idea, and it was a theatrical idea, I think, what would it be like to do a rock and roll show and to build, physically build a wall between the band and the audience? Because this is what I feel like when I'm on stage, as an expression of my feelings of alienation in the situation I find myself in, where audiences care about nothing except making a noise and letting off fireworks and getting drunk. So, which is kind of what the experience was like in North America. So when I'm writing The Wall, I'm then thinking, well, this is obviously, what's it actually about? So then I had to start confronting all of my feelings about what being alive is like. And what it's like for babies, all right? When the tigers broke three, what's it like when your father is killed by the Nazis, when your father, and what's it like when you're at school and teachers are extremely sarcastic and destructive in their treatment of you for all the reasons that they were then in that school in England, which was they were trying to maintain an authority that was very tenuous. Because the minute they opened themselves up to having a conversation with the students, they felt overwhelmed and that they could no, they had to hit you with a cane to maintain the fact that they were more important, they were superior to you.
So you
they
received physical punishment.
Well, it wasn't that it was rife. It wasn't like, it was based upon the traditional public school method of beating children into submission, boys into submission, right? And you got older boys to beat the younger boys. That's the whole public school system. It was called bagging. Like sixth formers, boys who were 15, 16 years old, about to leave school and go to, they had servants who were 10 or 11 years old or 8 years old to serve them, and they were allowed to beat them. This is the English public school system. This is where we learn to be such, what's the word, begins with the C and ends with an S. Anyway, so it's kind of weird. Well, the Cambridge High School for Boys was built upon that model. Call it the Eton model, if you like. Mm. You know, and it may be that Eton attracts well-educated and teachers to it because it's the top job in the land. So you have to be, at least pretend to be, but it's built upon a hierarchical relationship that is kind of 18th century France before the revolution. It believes upon the divine right of kings, you know, followed by prime ministers and schoolmasters, and then prefects. And it's all done with physical control. So there is a lot of beating that goes on with it. That's why there's Flashman in Tom Brown's School Days, you know.
How come your classmate remembers your grammar school as a nice period? How come?
Because there are people who fit into an authoritarian system. Hmm. And also don't forget that they've been told that they're the creme. They're the creme de la creme. They've already been siphoned off the top of society. So the other 80% of society are the scum, criminals, vagabonds, nobodies. Don't write them off. They're meaningless. You are the cream. And so you are privileged, and we were, to be there. From here, you can get a scholarship and go on to Cambridge or Oxford or one of the lesser universities, but you can get a university. You can't from a secondary modern school. You are destined to go into the workforce age 15 if you go to a secondary modern school and do whatever the fuck you're told or whatever you can. There's no escape from it. So if you're one of the selected 20%, I can easily imagine you thinking, well, this is all right. This is cool. Look, I'm one of the elite. I can go on and start my own estate agency and be the boss of a company because I'm boss material. That was decided when I was 11 plus years old.
So these kids who finished your grammar school, they weren't saying, we don't need no education. It brought them an awful lot. We don't need no mind control. It brought them everything.
You have to understand, this is like, there were journalists when the war came out who thought that I was railing against education. No, I'm not. I'm railing against thought control. I'm railing against the lack of education, in real education in the system. I'm railing against propaganda. I'm railing against the ruling class destroying the fucking earth. That's what their system of education was for. It's to say, listen, if you really were, like, there's a kid in my memoir who I mentioned, who was in my second year at school, and I mentioned him. His name was Hayden Phillips. He's probably still alive, just he's my age. But he was the creep who the film master adored. And said, look at Hayden Phillips, what a wonderful, he was very polite, he worked very hard and diligently and blah, blah, blah. Guess what became of him? I know what became of him because I looked him up afterwards. I looked him up a couple of years ago. You wouldn't believe it. You could not write it. He went from there, he got good A-levels, he got into Clare College, Cambridge. He then went and did postgraduate studies at Yale. So he spent a couple of years in America. He then joined, what's it called? I can hardly remember any word. The civil service. What I refer to as the cupboard full of hot buttered toast that is the civil service in England. And he ended up as Sir Hayden Phillips, KCBG, fucking something or other, head of the Honours Committee.
Really?
Victory.
Amazing.
You couldn't fucking make it up. It's so kind of wonderful in its irony. And so that's it. So it may be that John Pocock, who I didn't know, but I love his paintings. So some part of him flourished through that because he made beautiful paintings of Co Fen and Grantchester Meadows and the river in the middle of winter and shit like that. So who knows? Different strokes for different folks. I mean, I walked straight into a quite well-known school of architecture.
Yeah, you did.
I refused to go to a provincial university in England. I had a scholarship to go to Manchester University to study mechanical engineering. Amazing. And one night, I woke up in the middle of the night. I was in August sometime. I was supposed to go in September. And I banged on my mum's door. Who's that? You know, Roger, do you know what time it is? No, I don't. What time? But whatever. And I said, I'm not going. I am not going to Manchester University to study mechanical. And of course, she went apeshit. We had a long conversation in the middle of the night. And it all unfolded to it. You have to do something, you know. You don't want to end up like my friend Austin selling fucking vacuum cleaners for the rest of your life. I know you. You're too bright for that. You're going to need an education of some sort.
Yes.
If you're going to do anything even faintly interesting. It's interesting that what I learned to do, I didn't do. The pop group thing, which is like a million to one chance, somehow came off. But nobody could possibly have predicted that, could they? But I did learn enough. I learned enough maths and physics and shit like that at school that I could cope with building instruction and bending moments and civil engineering falling off a log. It's just easy. It's such simple math.
So you told your mother you're not going to university. So you had this conversation until the mid, in deep in the middle of the night. So what happened afterwards?
You know, this is the funny thing. Well, a funny thing, deep in the middle of the night. The only reason I kind of remember some of this stuff this clearly is that I have just been writing a memoir. So a lot of this stuff is in the memoir. I'll never forget in the middle of that. She was thinking like crazy. And before she came up with the answer, which she may not have done till the next day, she suddenly said to me, "What about the police force, Roger?" And I went, "What? The police force? You could..." I said, "Mum, I am not joining the old bill. That is not going to happen." She, "Well, you know, you could, you'd only have to do a 2 or 3 years on the beat, you could join the CID. It might be very interesting work and perfectly laudable and blah, 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 blah." And I went, "Mum, no, that ain't going to happen." So I already had some weird seeds about the idea that somehow I wouldn't fit in the police force. But she then said to me, "There's a place I've been reading about. It's called the National Institute of Industrial Psychology. It's in London. And you go there for 2 days. You can stay with Auntie Bri or whatever. And you do aptitude and intelligence tests and all. And they come back and then and they make suggestions as to what you should do. And they also tell you whether you're equipped for university or not intellectually. Blah, 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 blah. Will you do that? Promise me." And I went, "Yes, Mum, I promise." And so I did. And I did my 2 days, and obviously they went, "Fuck me, this kid's bright." But they also said, "But he has things he can't do. He's completely useless at doing mechanical, clerical jobs. Like, if you give me 2 lists of names to check, are they the same? I've finished, and nearly all of them are wrong. I can't do it. But equally, if you give me a complicated drawing of a machine and say, when you pull lever A, what happens to lever B? I know the answer without thinking about it. I just go, this, that, that." So it's weird. Anyway, so it said architecture. So then the only problem was that I had to produce a portfolio of drawings, and I hadn't done any art since I was 10. You know, I didn't do art at school. I went with the science side of things. So I had to go and learn art. I had to learn to draw, to do some. So that was cool. And I found I could do that. It's what's so hard? You just look at something and put it on a piece of paper. It's called drawing. It's not hard. Except it is quite hard, but I have a weird eye. It's like when I'm in a room, sometimes we could do that. And I go, "Well, the problem with that is the ceiling's not level. You know, it's a quarter of an inch or half an inch higher at that end. Don't be daft. You can't possibly know that." I say, "I can. I can see it. It's sort of obvious."
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that was a... I quite enjoyed studying architecture for a bit, but there was, you know what I didn't like?
Did you finish your studies?
No, I did 5 years.
5 years?
Yeah. I did my first year, but I was a little bit rebellious. So they then suggested that I should definitely pursue my studies in architecture because I was really good at it, but that I needed to work on the rebelliousness a bit. So they thought it would be good for me to go out and to work somewhere for a year. So they threw me out for a year. So I did DA1, then I did a year working in an office, then I went back in and did DA2, the second year. Now I've done 2 years actually there, but it's my third year. And then I did DA3, okay? So after DA3, you get your diploma in architecture, but you haven't done your professional practice exams. There are 2 more years to go. So I did DA3, and then I went to work in an office again, Portland Place, a firm called Fitzroy Robinson. And I was in the middle of that year when we signed a contract with EMI. So I went to my team leader and I said, listen, I've got this chance to play in a pop group and I'm going to take it. And he was very nice. He went, well, anytime you need a job, come back. We will really miss you and blah, 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 blah. I said, well, that's very kind of you and I thank you for that.
Did you apply any of the skills you learned in architecture in your career as a musician?
Maybe. It's possible, you know, that particularly in terms of stage design, designing rock and roll shows, which, you know, I did a lot of. From Dark Side of the Moon on, the shows got more and more complex. And all the ideas about using inflatables and projection and this, and then the wall itself. Yeah, it was fairly architectural. And I worked only with architects. Like Mark Fisher was a contemporary of mine, and he had trained at the Architectural Association, which was the other very good architecture school in London, along with the Regent Street Polytechnic. Then there was another one that was London University, that's called the Bartlett, and there was one in Cambridge University, and those were really the only four schools of architecture in England. So I did learn odd bits and pieces of stuff. So what I didn't like about it, let me just say this because I have to get it in. One of my tutors in the first year, Richard Rogers was one of the guys who went on to become a hugely eminent sort of town planning type architect, but he designed the Pompidou Center all those years ago in Paris and blah blah blah. And he's a lovely man with a lovely wife, Ruth, who had a fantastic restaurant in London. That's nice. Norman Foster, who was a complete prick. He went on to build that horrible pineapple-shaped thing in the City of London, which is still there to his eternal discredit. And he's enormously successful all over the world. So he obviously has no sense of aesthetic at all, because he's fucking awful. But he was probably good at the bit that I couldn't bear, which is the being polite to clients bit. It's very political being a successful architect. You have to convince so many people that work. Anyway, whatever. That's neither here nor there.
Well, a bit earlier you said, going back to education, you said, well, some people thought Brick in the Wall was an anthem, anti-education anthem or something. It was not. You're not against education. But then you have to admit that the sentence, we don't need no education, is a bit misleading.
Well, if it's misinterpreted, it is or not. Because you're right. It's actually a song about rebellion. But it depends what you're rebelling against. Whether it's not a song about, sorry, you had a hair on you then, about rebelling against education. It's a song about rebelling against bad education.
Exactly.
Where the people who are trying to educate you are trying to get you to toe the line. Okay. It's not about expanding your horizons or making it easier for you to interpret the world that you live in and to find the parts in you and yourself and your personality that are creative and loving. It's about trying to make you into the right shaped cog to fit into the machine that goes on making money for the ruling class.
Exactly.
So it's two different definitions of education.
So
my contention would be that the double negative in the line, though I don't think I thought this through intellectually at the time, we don't need no education.
Don't and no.
Yeah, don't and no. If you actually take it literally, we don't need no education. We need good education, you know. Or it could have said, we don't need bad education. We don't need dark sarcasm in the classroom.
Exactly.
Teacher, leave them kids. Because we had that a lot in my school, ruling through sarcasm and through putting the kids down in order to maintain the hierarchy of control, in order to create cogs to fit neatly into Starmer's Britain. It's no different now than it was when I was at school.
Keir Starmer's Britain is not different from the Britain you were living in as a kid. You've got to be kidding. For example, corporal punishments or physical punishments in school or dark sarcasm, is it still the case in British education?
Certainly not physical. No, you can't get away with beating kids physically. I honestly don't know. I mean, I do think things changed when comprehensive education was introduced in England. Though this is not, I have no expertise in when I'm talking about the organisation of education in England, because I'm not at school now. But what I do see when I go back there is generations of disaffected youth.
Hmm.
And I do see that the divisions between the ruling class and the working class, and those classes do exist. Don't let anybody try and fool anybody.
I agree.
And they are greater. The divisions are greater now than they were when I was at school, because I was at school there in the 60s. In the 50s and 60s. I think 55, or I'm not sure what year it was. I was 12. So that was, 55. I went to my grammar school. So it's the 50s mainly that I was there. Well, the divisions are even greater now than they were then, because the experiment to reduce those divisions that happened after the Second World War in England with the Labour government, with the Attlee government, and the Beveridge Report, and trying to change society so that it was a more level playing field. That has been done away with. And it was done away with by Tony Blair and Margaret Thatcher, by and large, in that little bit of time when Blair capitulated to the American war machine, and Thatcher, in her infinite blinkeredness, because she wasn't a stupid woman. I mean, she got a fucking first from Oxford. She must be intellectually capable. She was just emotionally incapable of understanding that there's more to life than getting a first.
She was called the Iron Lady, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I see. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, in her declining years, her popularity depended entirely upon the sinking of the General Belgrano as it steamed back towards Argentina from the Falkland Islands. So, and that all gets shoveled to one side. So it may well be that there is still a big section of the English population who supported the sinking of the Belgrano, and who, the further right she became, the more fascist Margaret Thatcher became, the more popular she became. That's what this resurgence of fascism in England is all about now. It never goes away. It's always the same question. Can we identify the black people or the Chinese or anybody foreign or somebody with a different political idea as the enemy, so that we, the brave island people, can keep them out and fight against them and stop their ideas spreading and interfering with the purity of our Saxon blood? This is the third right.
Is that what Rishi Sunak did with the Rwanda Treaty? I think it was Rwanda or some other African country.
I don't know about the politics of that treaty.
There was a treaty, an agreement, and Sunak said, well, I'm going to send back refugees from a certain African country, and we're going to donate or give them £100 million pounds or whatever in order to get their own people back. Is that what...
Well, it's what's in the... It's like... Even in the general election that happened just this time round now, the Reform Party with, what's his name, Farage, is still made significant inroads. And basically, they're the League of Empire Loyalists. They're the same people who followed Oswald Mosley in 1936, 37, 38, before the Second World War. You can always find people, probably in any society, who like who kind of like caveman politics. Well, he's the biggest one, so he's our leader, and he can go and kill the bloke next door, and then we'll all be all right. It's what it's like a microcosm of or rather the US empire that we see now is exactly that. It's a big fucking caveman killing everybody, stealing everything they've got. And it's quite popular as a model. That's what presumably why it's followed by all the European nations now, including Holland, dare I say, which I would never have believed 20 years ago. No, the Dutch wouldn't follow, go down that road, would they? I don't know. You live there. You tell me. They're part of NATO.
Wait a second. Battery, where's the battery? Doing weird. They're part of NATO, yeah. And our former MP, minister president, Mark Rutte, is going to be NATO's leader. You know him, Mark Rutte?
No.
He was the Dutch prime minister, and
Right.
he was promoted to head of NATO a couple of months ago. So
I read.
the Netherlands
I.
are very proud of their former prime minister because he's
Right.
going to pursue the policies that are already in place. So it's a bit troubling. I find it really troubling that he's become NATO's head.
I've got a. I suddenly had a. What's the time? Yeah, I can. Yeah, I'm all right for a little bit. Not for very long. So
So,
maybe I should. I was going to look up a letter I wrote to the people of Holland.
oh, that
Like,
would be interesting, but you can't find it.
well, I don't. Let me have a look.
Why did you write the letter? What was the purpose of the letter?
We need to find it to find out. I'm just typing in "Dear People of Holland" and seeing if it comes up with anything. Don't think it did. No, this is something else. It might take me. I might send it to you if you want. Let me just have one more look. I'll have a look in Word and see if it's in here.
Is it a recent letter?
It's probably within the last 10 years. I'm just going to try one more thing and then I'm going to give up. I know I can find it, but it's. I'm just going to look somewhere else. Because I have a thing called letters, and it might be.
Yeah.
No, it wouldn't be letters to colleagues.
You have a letter to Putin in there,
Ah!
ready.
Oh no, that's Howard Stern. I nearly read. It's things like, "Dear Lana Del Rey, dear Lord, dear Dionne Warwick, a letter to Alan Parsons."
Putin, dear Zelenska,
Yeah,
you.
I've got one of those, definitely.
You
No,
made
it's
me
not.
so curious. Yeah.
I know. I'm sure I can find it. Maybe what I could do is. Well, no, I've got more time now. Let me just have
No
a look.
problem. No
Let
problem.
me.
And it starts, dear people of Holland.
I think it says to the people of Holland.
Or maybe the Netherlands. Have you tried?
What? No, I wouldn't have said that.
No. Because some people might be offended because Holland is just a small part of the Netherlands.
Welcome. I don't care if they're offended. Yeah,
No,
they're doing now the difference between Holland and the Netherlands. Yeah, no, it's not. This is going to put. Let me look again. Let me look again.
Are you in New York now, at home?
No, I'm in Barbados.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. I'm doing a. I'm having a sojourn in Barbados. Barbados. I'm really enjoying it as well.
Yeah, I can
It's
imagine.
a pretty cool place to be. People are really nice. Just going to try once more here with Word documents. I'm needing to find a key, some kind of a key word that
Key
would
word,
find.
yeah. What's the topic?
The topic was the children of a Muslim who'd gone to fight in Iraq with ISIS, who married a Dutch woman who
Yeah.
went out there to join him, and he was killed.
Yeah.
And she then left the children on a road in northern Syria, I think, and they were taken to a camp, and it was all about me trying to rescue them. And I wrote a letter, an open letter to the people of home. Maybe it's an open. Let's try that. Now, I've got two: an open letter to Mrs. Olena Zelenska and an open letter to Vladimir Putin. It's not either of them.
But maybe if you Google the name of the lady, because I know her name
I
is.
can't remember. I can't remember what her name was. If I could remember her name, I
Let's see.
would put.
Let me help you, because I know the case you're talking about. It was
Do
really
you?
a controversy here in the Netherlands, because people were thinking, well, she's a terrorist. She chose to be there, so leave her there. So I know that was the
Yes.
public opinion.
Okay, well, can you look it up if you can? That would be great. I would like that. Oh no, this is a possible one. Ah, found it. Okay, here we go.
Here
I'm
we
going to
go.
bring it up. And it's not that old. I'm going to cover you up now. I think it's sometime in 2022, so it's only a couple of years ago. Dear Holland, please bring your children home. My name is Roger Waters. 50 years ago, I co-founded a band, Pink Floyd. Okay, enough of that. One of my mum's closest friends was a Dutch woman, Maria. Maria lived through the occupation of Holland in World War II, and she would routinely send coded messages from the Dutch resistance to England, apparently based on some of the intelligence Maria sent via Red Cross mail to friends in England. The RAF managed to identify and bomb a specific building in Amsterdam, Gestapo headquarters, without collateral damage to the local people. This extraordinarily courageous act saved lives. True? Question mark. We will never know. Full stop. The point is, Maria was a brave Dutch woman dedicated to the saving of life. You, the Dutch, have that reputation, brave, principled, and dedicated to the saving of life. Speaking of dedication to saving life brings me to my old friend Clive Stafford Smith, founder of the English organisation Reprieve. Just before Christmas, our paths met by chance, and Clive told me about two Trinidadian boys, Mahmoud and Ayub Ferreira, stranded in a detention camp in northeast Syria. It's a long story, but between us, we managed to get them out and back to their mum, Felicia, in Trinidad. The hardest part of the process was to persuade the government of Trinidad and Tobago to provide passports for them and an emergency passport for their mother to facilitate their repatriation to their homeland. Why should you care about two Trinidadian kids? Because dominoes fall, full stop. I'm writing this because you have two Dutch children in the same situation, Mariam and Zachariah. They are from Holland. They are 3 and 2 years old, respectively. When Clive and I flew to Syria to rescue Mahmoud and Ayub, we were lucky to have their mother, Felicia, to accompany us. No such luck with Mariam and Zachariah. Their mother, Zole, died of malnutrition and complications in northeast Syria. Mariam and Zachariah are orphans confined through no fault of their own to a detention camp in a foreign land. There are 2,622 foreign detainees from 46 different countries in the Kurdish camps in northeast Syria. Of these, the largest group, 1,248, are children who can hardly be deemed guilty of any crime, yet they are condemned to try to survive with no adequate shelter through a Syrian winter. The World Health Organization reports that at least 29 kids have died in the camp since Christmas. Okay, here is the rub. I have no doubt that you, the Dutch people, would repatriate these two kids in a heartbeat. Unfortunately, your government is putting up obstacles. Quote, how do we know they are Dutch citizens, say the bureaucrats. Well, their mother, and nobody disputes that they are, named Zole's children, if that was her name, I don't know, held a Dutch passport. If you believe in human rights at all, bring these children home. Part of the problem facing your bureaucrats is that all detainees being held by the SDF in northeast Syria are assumed to be terrorists. Wrong. Most of them are children and the rest, most are women. They should all be presumed innocent and at least given a fair trial. It makes no sense to presume that everyone who happened to be in Syria during the ISIS years deserves to die there. So back to Mariam and Zachariah. Can we together persuade the Dutch government to uphold the Dutch reputation for fair-mindedness and bring these children home now? Their mother's reasons for going to Syria in the first place, we may never know, but it makes no difference now. One thing we can all recognize is that Mariam and Zachariah are as innocent as the day they were born. Sadly, the Dutch government is looking for ways to duck its responsibility. Perhaps they think it is too dangerous and difficult to get two children home from northeast Syria, or perhaps they're subject to outside pressure. Well, Clive Stafford Smith and I got Mahmoud and Ayub out of Syria, thanks to the Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago, who ordered their travel documents, and thanks to the Kurdistan administration of northeast Syria and the Prime Minister of Iraqi Kurdistan and the government of Erbil, who facilitated their safe passage across the River Tigris and through the border procedures. Dutch bureaucrats say there is no proof the kids are Dutch. What? They are the children of an indisputably Dutch woman. If the government is in the mood to quibble, DNA testing can readily be arranged. Come on, guys. They're 3 years old and 2 years old. They're orphans. They're Dutch. Bring them home. If my mum and her friend Maria were still alive, they'd be out on the streets with the rest of us demanding succor for our loved ones. Mariam and tiny Zachariah are freezing and alone. Please prevail upon your government and bring them home. I didn't get a reply, weirdly enough. Wow. And I've no idea what happened to them. I did try and follow up, but I never could find them again.
Why them?
What?
Why them? How did you get to know them?
Oh, somebody sent me, I think, I, if I if I went and looked through all my photos, I've got a picture. I'll send it to you if you want. A picture of them with their mum. The mother is, I think it was the fact that it's a picture of the two kids with their mother. I don't know how I would find it in photos, but I could look. Because she's very photogenic, and she's got a real, she looks like a deeply wounded bird that's smiling at you. And she's got two baby birds with her, and it breaks your fucking heart. And you just automatically want to somehow help a bit. And there's thousands of these victims of this nonsense. They're only there because of the Americans decided to destroy the Middle East in 2003. And the Dutch and the English and everybody went along with them. So they are our responsibility, and we can't save them all. So occasionally we try and save even one or two. But I wrote that letter to Holland just because who else?
Where did you publish it?
Well, online.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, you don't know how these girls ended.
No, I'll send it to you. Fucking publish it. You're there. You know, I can't. I mean, you see, no mainstream media anywhere in the world will ever publish anything that I send to them. I ask difficult questions. How could you read that letter and not go, you know, he's right. We have to find these children and bring them home.
It's really confronting. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's find out what
please research it more. I'll send you the photo if I can, because we can only do so much. Every morning we wake up and our fucking hearts are broken, and we try and think, I'm doing you now. I sort of should have finished you now because I've done an hour and 20 minutes.
Let's end on a happier note. I wrote you 50 seconds of music. I'm a musician by trade. I studied flamenco guitar in the Rotterdam Conservatory. And, you know, I misspelled your name when I first sent you an email. It was a bit shameful. This song I wrote, it's just a 50-second guitar ragtime. It's called Mr. Noel Walters. And I know you know the person better than I do. So I would like to end with that short, very short story about Mr. Noel Walters, because I thought it was hilarious. So let's end on a funny note.
So what, you want me to tell you the story?
Please, and then I'll play you the song.
All right. Well, this is, I don't usually tell people this story when they get my name wrong and call me Walters, but I'll tell you. When I was a very young man, probably at the very beginning of Pink Floyd, I went to rent a car one day, just a cheap fucking car to go take the boys to a gig in or something. And I went in and the woman said, yes, okay. Yes, I'd like to rent a car, please. And she went, very well, I'll fill in the form for you. Name, right? And I said, Waters. And she said, Walters. So to be helpful, I leaned forward and I said, Noel. And she went, Mr. Noel Walters.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
I will record it and I will send it to you. And so I have time to practice. So, Roger, thanks a lot for the time you took to talk to me.
No, I like talking to people who care about things. And you obviously do care about things. And so it's time well spent. It's what I search for. I actually search for moments when I can talk to people who give a fuck. You know, it's really, really important. So thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Roger. I just sent me the picture of the Syrian, the Dutch children in Syria, and I will try to find out what happened to them.
Good. And I'm going to look at that photo right now, and when I find it, I'll send it to you.
Excellent. Roger, thanks for having this conversation.
Sure. Thank
Enjoy
you.
Your day. Bye-bye.
All right. I will. Goodbye.